Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. Today's Friday, May 10th. I'm Stephen Overley. The relationship between Washington and the tech industry has gone through no shortage of ups and downs over the years. Friendly to hostile, hostile to friendly, and back to hostile again. But things were all smiles earlier this week at an AI expo hosted by the Special Competitive Studies Project. In the Washington Convention Center, big tech firms like Meta, Google, Palantir, and Microsoft had their latest technology on display, in booths alongside the likes of the Department of Defense and the National Security Agency. The CEO of the Special Competitive Studies Project, Ely Bayraktari, told me that's the whole point. He thinks government and industry need to work together for the U.S. to beat China on AI. If you don't know SCSP, here's the skinny. It's a DC think tank that was born out of the National Security Commission on AI, a body set up to advise the White House and Congress that has since disbanded. Ely was the commission's executive director, and the commission's former chair was ex-Google CEO Eric Schmidt. He's the founder and chair of the Special Competitive Studies Project. Washington is a small world. I sat down with Ely for a live taping of Politico Tech during that AI expo. We talked about the Washington-Silicon Valley divide and how AI and China are bringing them back together. Here's an edited version of our conversation. So thank you for being on Politico Tech today.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
So we are at first ever AI Expo for national competition that you've organized. Tell me quickly, what was the impetus for putting on this event?
Yeah, that's a great question, Steve, that I've been getting for the last 2 days, maybe. When we started at CSP, when you look at our mission and our objectives, one of the key things was how can we bring public and private sector much, much, much closer together? Because what you have seen probably since the end of the Cold War is innovation happening in private sector, but with the release of ChatGPT and the power of AI, you know, we needed these communities to talk more, engage more, get closer together, because I think we are going to face a really challenging period between now and 2030. I mean, you can already see sparks of that challenging security environment with China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. But what's more important is that China, our predominant competitor, is really also a major tech competitor. So how do you compete against a competitor that is so advanced, that has enormous resources, tremendous companies, but also they have similar fusion? We will never be China. But what we have is a public-private partnership dialogue that through that channel, we can much more effectively compete against China.
You talked about bringing sort of government and industry together. And if we think about it, I mean, the relationship between Washington and the tech industry has been fraught in recent years. You know, now at this expo, you have a lot of vendors here, but it includes some of the big players, Meta, Google, Microsoft. How do you characterize the relationship today between Washington and tech industry?
That's a great point. And I think you're spot on your observations. I worked in the Department of Defense for 12 years, from 2010 to 2022 almost. And I was part of the process in 2016-17 where former Deputy Secretary of Defense Bob Work launched Project Maven. I hate to say it, but I was one of the guys that brought that memo for him to sign. But we all know what unfolded. You know, Google pulled out. They didn't want to be part of Maven. Completely different sentiment, completely different discourse in Silicon Valley about how they viewed their relationship with the Department of Defense. That has changed completely today. We see a 180 degrees shift. I think two factors contributed in that shift. Number one is, over time, China's use of surveillance technology against minorities started to wake up a lot of people in Silicon Valley that actually China is not a country that we all thought is going to be, and the way they were using these technologies against their minorities was maybe a first indication of their ambitions and their goals with the technology. And then the second piece was really the war in Ukraine. I go to Silicon Valley quite often, but ever since the launch of the Russia invasion of Ukraine, you know, most of the conversations I have in Silicon Valley are about that. And I think what you have seen also, the private sector playing a critical role in Ukraine, whether it's through, you know, manufacturing small capable drones, software capabilities. We have a lot of software companies that are there. So completely different shift in that sentiment between, you know, Silicon Valley and Washington. And so, yeah, completely different reality we live in today.
To what extent does AI in particular kind of change that calculus in the relationship? Because you have a technology that Washington and the national security community see as pretty critical to maintaining a lead. And you also have a technology that industry sees as potentially very lucrative and transformative too, right? So
absolutely.
It seems like that technology alone
is
kind of a catalyst here.
No, absolutely. You're right. I think, look, there are two moments here. You have the pre-ChatGPT moment, and I think you have the post-ChatGPT moment. I was fortunate, as you mentioned, to lead the AI commission that Congress created from 2018 to 2021. This is the pre-ChatGPT moment in which our job was to look at what are we doing with AI within all the departments and agencies. We had to look at how good they are in terms of buying and using, what they're using it for. And I got to tell you, we produced a lot of reports. I think our bumper sticker line from that point was, there are islands of hopes in how they're thinking about using AI, but they remain islands of hope. And then ChatGPT moment happened, and I think that was a wide opening moment for the government agencies that we live in a new era. So now we have to look at it from a whole of nation approach to AI adoption, from like policy adoption to what are we going to use it for? What are the guardrails so we don't increase societal differences,
right,
but rather like enable protection around, you know, groups that need protection from this technology. So you have a completely new now policy approach from Washington about AI.
You mentioned earlier how, you know, because of China's system, they can sort of compel their tech companies to serve their national interests. Should U.S. tech companies feel a sense of obligation or duty or whatever you want to call it to advance U.S. national security interests?
I mean, look, we live in a democracy. I'm an immigrant, so I'm a big believer in checks and balances and the way the United States political system is set up. I would also say that, you know, we live in a system which your company doesn't want to work with the, you know, like federal government. It's their choice. And there are probably many companies that decide that way. We're not China, as I mentioned. We will never be China. And I'm thankful for that. But the one thing you got to remember is we are in a serious competition for the next 7 years against a competitor that is our competitor across all domains, political, military, financial. We have never had a competitor like China in the last 200 years. And I don't think the American people realize how serious China competition is. We wrote a report in September of 2021, and we laid out the first chapter is what would losing to China look like. And so we depict a future, not distant future and not sci-fi future, in which what would the world look like in 2025 if you and I wake up and everything we do on our phones, everything we buy online, the phones that we use, the antennas, routers, and the transformers of our digital life all are made, built, and deployed by China.
What do you think is most underestimated about China?
I think the digital infrastructure they have built globally is probably one thing that you don't realize it because you don't see it, right? I mean, we all live a digital life, but when you look at the 5G global map, it's primarily red. And this is one thing that we overlooked. You know, we closed our eyes. What China did through Huawei is build cheap, subsidized platform, and they deployed it globally. They offer it to countries in a very cheap version. Unfortunately, we didn't have an answer to their 5G. We still don't have an answer to 5G unless we partner with our allies and partners. But then you woke up and you see that, you know, there may be a handful of countries that don't use Huawei. And those are primarily our allies.
Right.
But most of the world have one way or another a digital infrastructure that is built and used and deployed by Chinese companies.
Do you worry China will replicate that with AI, whether that's with chips or that's with AI models?
Yeah. So they're not going to stop. I mean, they're not going to stop because they know we are in a tech competition. And they know, I think they also believe that there are shortcuts that through tech competition, they can get ahead of us. And I think they're trying. If you look, they're pretty clear in terms of where they want to be. They want to be everything made in China 2025. They want to be global AI leader by 2030. They want to set the global technology standards by 2035. So this is not just me interpreting their vision. These are government documents they publicly spoken by their government officials about the vision for their country.
Right.
You know? And so I think they see a path. They're investing enormous resources. They produce enormous capable talents for these things. Their universities produce a lot of computer science students. So I think they have a strategy they're implementing. How they're going to be successful, that's a different thing. I mean, as you know, we still lead in a lot of areas, to include AI, chips, because of NVIDIA. But this competition is dynamic. It's not static, as you know. Like, it's not that we can stop today and say, like, okay, we won, now it's over, let's stop, let's pause. This is going to be a continuous competition because the technology is so evolving every day.
You know, we've seen the Biden administration and Trump administration before that put export controls in place to try to, you know, slow or impair in some ways China's tech development. Congress has now invested billions of dollars in U.S. chips manufacturing. What more can be done right now to keep the U.S. ahead of China, in your view?
So look, $52 billion were like really a down payment. They're not an investment for a long term. It's a down payment. So we secure the lead that we have right now by building some of the manufacturing capabilities at home and then start thinking about what kind of next generation chips and semiconductors we need to produce to stay ahead. Because as you know, AI depends on the quality of chips. The export control is how we protect what we have, I think, and you know, just enable that lead for a while. I think the one area I would argue, and we have argued as SCSPs, we need to invest in basic non-research and development funding. When you look at historically what has happened is, since the end of the World War II, until the end of the Cold War, government invested so much in basic research and development through universities, through labs. That's why most of the innovations came from those places. When you think about it, during the Cold War, DARPA was the center of innovation. You know, internet was invented there. You know, Siri was invented in these government labs, when you think about it.
Right.
End of the Cold War, government, you know, starts like slowing down investments. Private sector picks up the basic R&D investments. And now look at where we are in the situation, which all the innovation comes from private sector. The second piece we have to do better are people. We got to find ways to build domestic STEM talent. I think AI gives you an opportunity for that. You got to find ways to keep talented immigrants in this country. I think H-1B is one of the pathways to keep those people here. I'm an immigrant myself. And there are so many people that come and study here, especially these critical technologies. We should be able to provide them with a clear pathway. The third category of people is really people that exist in private sector, but we desperately need in our government.
Right.
Because there's no way for you to write policies when you don't know what you're talking about. So we need these people to join government. So we need to find pathways for these people to join faster than the traditional, you know, recruitment processes existing in government.
You know, you mentioned this final report that the National Security Commission on AI issued back in 2021. I was reviewing that ahead of our interview today. And there were some...
You read 750 pages?
I read it all, sped read. No, put it in AI, had it summarize it for me. It was easy.
That's smart. That's
right. No, but a couple of the points made in there, it talked about the need for the government and the military to be AI ready by 2025.
Yeah.
That's now 7 months away.
Oh, wow.
To 2025.
Right. Yeah.
Are they ready?
So when we wrote that, what we meant by being AI ready, it's not that they will be able to have all the applications in place and are using everything. What we argue is, you know, having AI, you need the infrastructure beneath it. You need data to be talking to, you know, everybody in DoD has a lot of access to a lot of data. Every service has a lot of data. We need that data to communicate with each other. We need algorithms to be built on these data. We need talent to be... So that was the purpose of we saying be AI ready by 2025. Once you have that foundation, you can see from all the major tech companies, you can build whatever you want. But without that critical foundation in place, you know, you can't do much. I think they're moving, but we'll see. You know, I can have this conversation maybe next year and assess, are we AI ready by 2025? I would argue that we will be much, much ready than we are today. But probably, you know, knowing how government functions, things are still going to move very, very slowly.
How much does that readiness depend on buying and using technology made by the private sector? Because, you know, the reason I ask this, if you look at sort of the past federal and defense technologies, right, you can find no shortage of examples of systems that are delayed or overly complicated or just don't really deliver as expected. And so I think it raises questions about how equipped the government even is to use and adopt this technology.
So look, for every government agency, it's going to be different. If you go to FEMA, if you go to Health and Human Services, completely different mission. And they're going to use AI for completely different purposes. For DOD, we argue that there are four core missions that DOD can use AI. Number one is back office responsibilities, cyber defense, travel sheets, all the mundane jobs that private sector has automated for a while, but we still do it the old way. And I think that's a low threat change. Congress probably supports DOD in that. It doesn't mean that we will lose the workforce. It would just mean that you would train the workforce for that human-machine interaction, right? The second category, I think, that war in Ukraine really showcases the area of indications and warning. You know, with satellites now, with open source, you can figure out really fast nowadays movements of troops and tanks or aircrafts. And I think when you look at the amount of imagery, you look at the amount of intelligence, this is one area that AI can be so beneficial for our departments and agencies, right? Because it can predict fires, it can predict hurricanes, things that probably the workforce will support it, Congress will support it. And I think it will just, it's an efficiency issue too. The third category is, which I think ChatGPT opened the new windows for us, is the decision making. Every decision maker in government wants more options. And I'm sure you have played around with ChatGPT or Gemini, but like if you say like, give me five options on any given things, you're gonna give you things that you never thought about it. Like you probably thought about three, but you didn't think about the other two. So what are those things that these tools can better inform our decision makers? The last category is probably the most sensitive one, but it gets most of the attention, the lethal autonomous weapon systems.
I was gonna ask you about this.
No, I know, but because this gets a lot of attention, rightfully so. People are, you know, always nervous about bringing new military capabilities online. But look, this area is not gonna move fast. The department knows how this is a serious issue. You know, in our interactions with the military is that they understand how difficult this topic is, how sensitive it is, so they're treating it in a responsible way. I would also argue that the movies have also influenced us a lot in a way of like, how does that scenario look like? Whether you're looking at Skynet or Terminator, all these outcomes that we have watched as we were growing up. So you just have to be realistic that the department has, for any given new capability, they have processes in place that are tested, evaluated before they even deployed anywhere. So this is not going to be something being bought off the shelf, given to a soldier so he can use it somewhere. That just doesn't work that way.
Well, are those systems in place currently, or do they still need to be developed? Because I think when you talk to, especially folks in civil society or in privacy, you know, they worry that I think we're on this slippery slope. And, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? We can be doing all these things in the name of national security, but are we going to end up with a society we really want?
No, so look, those are valid concerns, I would argue. I don't work anymore in government, so like, I don't know where we are with the latest and greatest, but I would also like to differentiate. When you talk about adopting ChatGPT for the purposes, you know, of defense, that's a really narrow objective, you know. If you look carefully, ChatGPT is not a lethal autonomous weapon system, right? And I think they're really an unknown trajectory of how you can use it for that purposes. When you talk about a much broader AI application, that's a completely different topic, right? But what we have argued time and again is the systems that you have in your cell phone, that you can use ChatGPT or Gemini or maps to give you a shorter route to get to the place or access to open source information, those all applications should be available to our men and women in uniform when you're facing a really security environment that is degrading by the day. And so you don't want to end up in a situation in which we wake up because of a major crisis and then we have to rush and build these systems or adopt these systems.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer was here earlier and he made a comment that, you know, the Senate is going to be releasing an AI policy roadmap in a few weeks. How are you hoping to see that address AI and national security?
I mean, look, there were so many legislations so far that have tried to address AI in national security. A lot of our recommendations from the AI Commission went through NDAA, became part of the NDAA. I think every time I've heard Senator Leader Schumer speak about his intention was that he wanted to strike the right balance between innovation and responsible use, which is a difficult balance to strike. But like, I think the legislation should encompass the things that we have to do to protect our people from the technology, but also the things that we have to do to stay ahead in this technology, and then specific areas that you need to adopt for the purposes of national security.
Well, Ely, thanks for joining us on Politico Tech.
Have a good one. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here on Monday.